Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this very episode, we are reviewing Supernova and The Night, a new segment called Classic Corner, where we're going to discuss a film that might be more deserving to be called a classic, which would be Midnight Run for this first edition. And our topic this week is why we are so fascinated by serial killers. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today are my fellow host, John Davenport.
Hey, nerd. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
We are actually recording this on YouTube Live for the first time, so we're just trying it out. So if you're watching on YouTube Live, you probably could be doing other things, but thanks. If you're listening on podcast form as usual, welcome back.
And also, you're welcome because you get the edited version.
Yes, you get all that stuff that you didn't, like, we were trying to figure stuff out. You don't have to hear any of that.
Right. You don't have to hear my stutter.
No, they'll still hear that. I'm fairly certain that'll come up at some point.
All right. Well, what do you need to do?
Not much. You know what? It's been a couple weeks since we've had John really excited about anything. And then this trailer comes out. And I just want to point out, like, before we talk about the Godzilla versus Kong trailer, which, fantastic, looks exciting, looks great. Before I even saw the trailer, it came out, and then before I even saw it, your Facebook profile picture had changed, your cover photo had changed,
twice.
You'd already posted it, and you'd already posted about it. So, am I fair to assume that you are really looking forward to Godzilla versus Kong?
You know, it'd be more accurate to say that I have absolutely nothing to look forward to in my life. But
oh my God, that's dark.
I'm pretty sure my life is going to be in the shithole for quite a long time, but this is going to be great.
Okay.
So you're really saying the only thing you have to look forward to is why it's so exciting.
Yes. To reiterate, to be very clear, the only thing that I have that's going to make me happy in the next foreseeable future is this goddamn movie.
Okay. All right. I can work with that. So why are you excited? Because I watched it, and I'll tell you what, looks like monster awesomeness. Adam Wingard has never let me down, so I'm not anything less than excited for it. He did The Guest. He did, what else did he do? Other stuff.
That looks
You're
great,
next. Yeah. He's done other things. He's a great director, but I love The Guest. It's one of my favorite movies. And this just looks like so much more fun than the last one, which had people problems, even though this has people problems too, but.
Yeah, this one really seems to, at least from the trailers, it really seems to understand the good parts of a kaiju movie, because what we saw so far was a lot of stuff in broad daylight, which reminds me of going back to Kong Island, which was another, like, you have Godzilla. That movie was great and it's fine, but it doesn't realize why everyone showed up to the movie, which is to watch Godzilla. And then you get Kong Island, and that movie realizes the only reason why we're here is to see a giant monkey beat the crap out of people. And then we have King of Monsters, which sort of gets it misses it in some spots. We pay a little bit too much attention to people, but this one, like, I'm so excited to see Kong, Godzilla, and I have theories out the wazoo about this one and how it's working.
Before you get to your theories, can I ask a legitimate question from somebody who's more of a novice and a purveyor of Kong than a aficionado of Kong and Godzilla?
All right.
Did Kong get roided up? I mean, what happened? Did he go for like the Rock program? Because I don't understand what happened where the last movie, he's a little guy. He's like Kevin Hart compared to now. Now he's like full size Gigantor. Why? What happened? He shouldn't be the size of Godzilla, should he? Is he on stilts?
No, he should be. What they explain on Kong Island, when they found the graveyard of the Kong's parents, like, those were giant-sized Kong creatures. And they were even larger than what Kong was as he's kind of like strolling around being King Kong. And John C. Reilly even says at one point in the movie, it's like, hey, he's still growing. He's still kind of a kid. And, you know, once he's big enough, he's going to be able to take care of us from these skull crawlers, is what we're calling those monsters. So you're talking, that was 1960s, I believe. So from the 1960s
70s, wasn't it? 70s?
I don't know that I'm going to question John on Godzilla.
Okay, all right. That was Kong. I'm questioning him on Kong.
That's fair. He's questioning himself now.
And see, what they were Vietnam, right? It was the Vietnam War they were at.
It was after the Vietnam War. That means after 1973.
Okay, so it was the very end of the Vietnam War. So 1973. So you're talking 1973 to like 30, 40 years later, enough growth to be...
Wheaties.
He's still smaller than Godzilla, but big enough to fight him.
Okay. I was just clarifying. Amanda, are you excited about this? I don't know if you're a big fan of... Rawr.
Monsters have not normally been my thing. The types of monsters that I'm interested in are like horror monsters, like Frankenstein and Dracula. So these have not really been my thing, but I will say they're fun to watch in a movie theater because it's basically just one big fight, which is all people are asking for, except for in the last one, we talked about the people problem. There was a little bit too much general people happening.
Yeah, people
suck. We don't care.
Yeah, we don't need people in a monster
Yeah,
movie.
I feel like everybody who's bought a ticket in the past and who plans on buying a ticket to Godzilla vs. Kong is there because they just want to see big monsters fight. Hoo hoo, monster. So
that's who I'm rooting for, by the way.
Yeah?
What?
Yeah.
You watch your mouth.
Godzilla's kind of like got all the advantage.
So? He's supposed to. God is in the first part of his name.
Oh my God. It's ridiculous. The only thing, I mean, we all know how it's going to end. Mothra, why did you say that name? And then it's over. So I don't care how everything else happens. I just want Count Kong to kind of, because he's kind of the underdog. He's the underape.
Mm.
He is. I mean, one guy has
in terms
like,
of the, is that really how it is?
God, you know, King Kong can do this with his hands. Like he can actually do this with his hands, and which is like touch his every finger to his thumb. So he has the advantage over Godzilla.
Opposable thumbs, is that what you're going with?
Yeah.
Okay. Godzilla has
and the ability of use
lightning
tools.
That comes out of his mouth.
It's atomic breath, not lightning.
Whatever. So he's got halitosis.
John's just going to correct every single thing you say.
You better believe it. This is my Super Bowl coming up. It's just as scripted.
He's been training for this moment his entire life.
Exactly.
You know what I want to meet? I want to meet the guy, and I know he's probably listening. Guy, how you doing? I want to meet the guy who's looking forward to watching Godzilla versus Kong based after they saw this trailer on their little iPhone on HBO Max. I want to meet the guy who's like, I can't wait to watch that in my office on break from my iPhone rather than, you know, a theater. I want to meet that guy and just say, why? Like, what happened?
I think
to you?
You know people like that.
I just don't understand.
Pretty sure we all know people like that.
I don't get it. Like, I don't know about you, Jim, but I am going to find a theater and I will be safe, take precautions, everything else, but I'm going to see that in a movie theater. If I had to drive, I would do so.
Oh, screw that. I'm probably going to lick the seats when I get there just to like
okay,
make sure it's worth it. I'm going to be like, I better get COVID after watching this because my life isn't going to get much better now. It's just downhill from here.
Oh, my God. The darkness.
I don't know what to do after that.
Should we fly to Florida and give him a hug?
No.
No.
No. No.
Oh, my gosh.
No. He does not want hugs.
Don't touch me.
Well, I'm glad that you're excited. And I think that's what, March 31st, I do believe. So
I do believe.
And they moved that one up. It's one of the rare movies moved up in schedule as opposed to backwards, which is a nice segue to our news roundup for the week. This is everything that happened in the world of entertainment over the past week. We haven't done this one in about a month because we've been doing other stuff.
Like not caring.
Yeah, I didn't care. But listeners care because they always don't want you to quit. So here's what's coming out. Or what's happened in news over the past week. The Blacklist just earned a season 9 renewal. So it's going to literally last forever.
I bet you're so excited.
Let me finish.
Did you cash out on that one yet?
Segue. 9 years. Tell the woman who she is. Like, just tell her. Because really, this is getting ridiculous. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about it.
This is abuse at this point.
It is. I feel personally assaulted at this point. Oh, my goodness. All right. Also that happened, Spyglass Media and Robert Rodriguez are rebooting the Spy Kids franchise. Lovecraft Country creator Misha Green is going to write and direct the next Tomb Raider film starring Alicia Vikander, which sounds really cool.
Whoop.
Many movies have been delayed over the past week, including No Time to Die, Quiet Place 2, BIOS, and a few others, which is why in last week's episode we talked about all the movies and TV coming out this year, but we left off most of the dates because of that. But like we said, Godzilla vs. Kong moved up, so get excited. The Great Gatsby is getting a TV miniseries for A&E Studios.
Snooze.
Disney Plus has pulled films like Peter Pan, Dumbo, The Aristocats, and Swiss Family Robinson from child profiles because of their, quote, negative depictions and or mistreatment of people or cultures. All right, Disney. There is a Harry Potter TV series in early development at HBO Max, and then Warner Brothers says there is not one. But then insiders say there is. I don't know what's right. Either way, you got to figure there's going to be a Harry Potter series at some point. It's just going to happen. The WWE Network is moving off its own streaming network and moving to the Peacock streaming network, which could make sports the next big win for streaming giants. There's a lot of sports out there. They're very popular. I don't know.
Whoever gets bowling wins.
Yeah. Man, can you imagine a bowling network? I would just, that's a great way to fall asleep on a regular basis. America's Most Wanted is getting a reboot at Fox. And lastly, we can stop the speculation. Amanda's stock took off this week. AMC Theaters is going to be just fine. Thanks to raising enough capital, AMC Theaters will make it through this brutal COVID situation and avoid bankruptcy. They are still working with HBO Max as of now on those films that are day and date released. They're doing them one at a time. But overall, AMC Theaters is going to be all right. All right. All right.
I was hoping you'd do that.
Of all of that, John, what did you think is the most interesting thing?
You know, a lot of it's a bunch of a snooze fest, but if I had to pick something,
yeah,
Harry Potter getting a TV show, because who doesn't need that story retold, huh?
Well, there's other ways they could, I mean, and granted, we want to clarify, Warner Bros. Said, no, there's not, but there's insiders told Hollywood Reporter, Variety, and a couple other outlets, yes, there is. So my guess is it's very, very early talks. They haven't worked out yet. Maybe they don't have J.K. Rowling on board. Who knows? What do you want to see then, if you're excited about that?
The movies are great, and of course, they're going to be sticking around for a while as far as being a movie thing goes, but the ability of saying, all right, well, we're going to do a 7-season-long series and actually focus on much more of the things that happen in the books versus like the abbreviated version, which we got out of the movies, because
what happens?
The books have much more layered things to them.
He still doesn't do anything until the last book.
I don't want them to focus on the books at all. Leave this story, this part of the Potter universe out of it. We've done enough. We've also found that not all of Fantastic Beasts has been great either. So we just need it.
I believe that last 2 years ago when that second movie came out, I believe someone was saying it was one of the best movies ever. It was like a 9.5 or some nonsense.
And
so
someone wouldn't let that be amended. So
because you can't, you gotta tame your
this
hype.
Is what we call a teaching moment.
It
Amanda.
Was teaching, and I learned from it.
No, we're bringing it back, because sometimes you got to like hammer away at these teaching moments where it's like, be very careful as to what you call the very best movie, because then you get stuck with like saying Winnie the Pooh gets 10. Really?
She stands by that, though.
I do stand by that.
Uh huh.
That
her?
Was an incredible film.
You could shut up. Godzilla vs. Kong is going to be a 10, maybe a 20 in your books. I don't even want to hear it. You've already given it. Hey,
whoa!
I'm just saying.
Let's be serious. If we're going to start pulling that, what did I give King of Monsters?
I don't remember.
I gave it like a 5.5 or a 6, maybe a 6.5 at most.
Well, you're wrong on that one. That was better than that.
Okay, you son of a bitch.
Anyway, my point was that there is a lot more that we can do with Harry Potter. There is so much time and so much magic that we can explore. I really want us to get away from Potter and get away from this specific time period and these specific characters. As much as I love them, and I do love them, it's just becoming tiring. And I know there's going to be a lot of resistance if it's anything attached to J.K. Rowling. There is.
People can think what they want. I mean, she's a great writer, so.
I'm curious how that will unfold. But I really think there's so much more we can do, and It's just trying to capitalize on the name. If we're doing a TV show with similar characters or similar storylines or expanding on something we've already talked about, if you liked Harry Potter, then you liked Harry Potter. If you didn't like it, then you didn't like it. I don't think we need to expand on it.
I didn't
don't raise
like
your
it.
Hand.
I wanna follow like Slytherin for a while. I mean,
there's some dark characters that we could follow, and there's
just make
I mean,
new ones. Just make it like I mean, Hogwarts hasn't been there for just 7 years or 8 years or whatever. So like, go earlier. Go show when Snape was all about Harry's mom or whatever, and show that scene or you know something along those lines. I mean, show me something else. I would really follow. I would like to follow a different sorting house. Is that what they're called, right? Because Harry Potter got really mundane for me. I just felt like every movie was I only read the first book. I didn't read any more than that. So every movie was the same thing. Harry Potter doesn't really do anything. He's chosen one. He's special. Keep him safe. Somebody saves him. There's a bad guy. Somebody saves him. That's every movie. Da 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 da. Then the last movie comes and he finally gets to do something. And it's really not that big. But he's a chosen one. I get it. I just want to get away from all of that and just do Slytherin. And just, or one of the other sorting houses and kind of follow them as they get into hijinks. So they learn about magic and maybe they fight with the darkness within, you know, something along those lines.
So Godzilla.
Well, outside of Godzilla, I'm actually excited about this Tomb Raider news that came out.
Yeah, Misha Green's really talented.
Yeah, I mean, their Lovecraft Country took a completely different turn than I was expecting, even though I kind of knew what to expect going in based on what they had told us about it. It was still really creative, and it makes me excited, especially having female on board, to direct a female-led film. And I think she's talented, I think it'll be good, and I'm excited for her career to get a little bit more traction.
I actually read the book for Lovecraft Country, and the show improves on the book.
That's always a huge compliment.
That is a huge compliment. Like, the book is fine. The show is better.
The show is better than the book? I never read the book, so.
Yeah, the show is actually better than the book, because what it does is it actually hits at a few things much harder than the show does, and really lets it sit in those moments, and then it improves on other aspects of the book that are just not as powerful or strong, and really lets you sit in those moments, and it's much, much more artistically or thoroughly thought out.
Okay. Well, there's not a whole lot else. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, but really nothing I get too excited. I think it's weird that Disney Plus is pulling Peter Pan and the Aristocrats. I just let parents parent. It's not your job, Disney, to parent. And I get it. I guess they're doing it to protect themselves, but I don't know. To me, I know parents are petrified of awkward conversations and stuff. I think that's important. I mean, when kids ask you about weird things they see in a movie, that's a great time for a parent to have the conversation about weird things. So,
right.
Or things that they don't understand, so they think are weird, not that aren't necessarily weird. So they see something out of place. So they see, wow, I can't believe that they would actually, you know, put a character in blackface or something like that. That seems wrong to me. And then they go to mom and they ask mom, and then mom can explain that to them. Hopefully mom gives the right answer and doesn't give a really crazy one. But typically that's a great time to have those conversations. I don't see that as a bad thing, personally.
The other thing is Disney has something either like a sexual undertone or like a racist undertone or a sexist undertone in almost all of their older films. So at what point are you really going to start like halting? Like, you'd have to do that to the majority of their catalog, especially their older catalog.
Or Lion King, when they're just killing everybody and eaten by hyenas.
And the news that we found out thanks to John about Lion King.
I was shook after seeing that.
You want to explain it? Because it's audio.
All right. So somebody on like TikTok put it together that hyenas actually don't eat lions. So, and the point in which Scar turns on Mufasa and then sends the hyenas to kill Mufasa, well, the reality of the situation is they weren't, like, Mufasa wasn't eaten by the hyenas. What turns out is that who does eat lions are other lions. And there's a point in the movie where Scar is walking around singing a song and everything, and he's playing with a skull, and you realize the skull that he's playing with is a lion skull.
It's dark.
Who didn't know that, though? Like, I already knew. I didn't know.
Me?
I didn't know it was the same. I didn't think
so
Mufasa.
So much of the internet.
But it definitely... I mean, pay attention to the movie you're watching. I don't know. I mean, he's playing with a freaking skull. That's an important story point.
Apparently, a lot of people did not put that together. That was Mufasa's skull.
I didn't think Mufasa's skull, but I definitely thought it's a lion skull because it looks just like a lion. And he's playing with. I thought it was just basically to infer, look how wicked this guy is. He's killed before. Probably should have thought that out a little bit more. I just didn't think it was quick enough for that skull to be licked clean.
Leave nothing behind. Waste not, want not.
Oh, exactly. Okay. Well, on that note, well, remember, you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can join our Facebook group or we're on Twitter at @BuyPopcorn. Our show is independently funded and Patreon does help fans support their favorite podcast. Once you sign up for our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider, you get immediate access to all content in your respective tier. And you get some early content as well. Amanda's doing WandaVision right now. That you'll get that a couple days early. You can get a bad movie night for Mulan. We just talked about that one. And there's some interesting, maybe offensive things said in there. And then we have a bonus episode every month as well. So definitely, you know, there's a lot of content. And shout out to Andrew Jeeves, because he's a longtime listener who just pledged for the entire year. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah.
What a champion.
Hero. Patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. All right, we've got two reviews for movies that are coming out this Friday, January 29th. We're recording this, obviously, before then. Manda, take it away. The first one is The Night I Saw It, You Lead.
Yes. So after a night out with friends, an exhausted married couple, Babak, Nita, and their baby take shelter in the grand but eerie Hotel Normandy. Throughout a seemingly endless night, mysterious disturbances ruin their night's rest as Babak and Nita soon realize they're locked in with a malevolent force that hungers for the dark secrets they've kept from one another.
Easy for you to say.
Easy for me to say. Aaron, sometimes and often horror films are used as an allegory for something else. Is that present in The Night, or is there anything otherwise deeper meaning here?
But I can't say.
Okay.
So, I mean, the whole movie is very reminiscent of, and I said this in my written review, which you can find at the site, combination of The Shining and 1408. So a Stephen King concoction in a way. It's really about how these people are trapped by both their own past as well as by this particular hotel, and they have to kind of piece things together if they ever want to hope to escape. And it starts very, very slow and cautiously, but the allegories are very pointed once you get to a certain point in the film. But unfortunately, the beauty of the movie, I think, is watching it unravel, kind of putting the pieces together, seeing if you can figure it out before our characters do, and then realizing that you either nailed it or you got something wrong, and then you get to the ending as well, which is a big, you know, might confuse you, might blow your mind, might see exactly what you thought you wanted to see.
Mm. In your review, which you so nicely plugged a few minutes ago.
You're welcome.
You mentioned that there is minimal dialogue in the film, which always is interesting. What do they use as a substitute to draw the viewer's attention?
Well, there's a beautiful sound design by Nima Feck Harara. I think I said that right. I really apologize. I could not find a pronunciation for it. But there's beautiful sound design that kind of accentuates the dread, the direness of the situation. And there is definitely, there's still dialogue. It's not like there isn't any. It's just minimal. There's really only two characters speaking for the most part. A couple supporting characters pop up here and there, but they're pivotal to the plot that I'm really big on not spoiling stuff. And it's mostly in Iranian or Farsi, which I thought was fantastic because often, you know, it's a U.S. production. And I think it's the first production, U.S. production that's been allowed to screen in Iran in 40 years, which, you know, is worth being commended. But it's primarily in Farsi. So you've got a large portion of the film in this where you actually have the lead character speaking Farsi. And why that is interesting to me, why I think that's important, is because too often in films like this where you have a couple that are of the same culture, the same nationality, ethnicity, whatever, and they speak a different language than English, they always talk to each other in English but with an accent. And it drives me crazy because, like I've said many times, my wife is a different ethnicity than mine and she speaks fluent Spanish. But when she's around her family, she always speaks Spanish because that's primarily what they use. So in movies, it always bugs me. It's like, you're doing that for our benefit, but that's not true to character. And here they really stayed true to character in that respect. I like that a lot.
So in your review, you also mentioned, you commended the two lead performances and the director being Karash Ahari, and the two leads being Shabab Hussain and, now I'm going to mess this all up because I already did the two, Nuisha Jafarian.
Mm-hmm.
And between those, between the director and the two leads, which you commended both of them, which is more of a standout, the director's take on the film or the two leads' performances?
I think the performances are really what sells it. And director does a great job. Ahari does a great job of building atmosphere. There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of sound design. There's a lot of pounding shocks. There's atmospheric changes. There's he's not afraid to let a scene play out, which I really appreciate in any kind of psychological thriller, you know, where it will hang longingly on a character's face while things build behind them, around them. Maybe you hear noises outside of them, you know, those kinds of scares. I really appreciate that. But Hussain and Jafarian are really what sell the entire film. Babak and Nita are just horrified and also kind of confused, and they sell both of those things. Plus, they have stuff that they need to work out, and they are not doing it well. So as we kind of find them trying to work those things out and trying to figure out what's going on, their characters go up and down in terms of psychosis, which is, I think, they're wonderful.
So if the full price of admission for the night were $10, what are you giving this film?
I give this one $6.
Okay.
All right, Supernova is one that Amanda saw. This is our second review, and then we're going to move to our topic this week. But Colin Firth stars as Sam, and Stanley Tucci stars as Tusker. I just love that name. I don't know why. They're a couple that are traveling across England in their old RV to visit friends, family, and places from their past. Since Tusker was diagnosed with dementia 2 years ago, their time together is the most important thing they have. So the plan is to final their journey at Guardhall, where Sam, a pianist, will put on a show. Now, this is a road trip film of sorts, and they can go a lot of different ways. But it also sounds like a screenplay by writer-director Harry McQueen follows a play structure, basically taking place in three different acts. Is that right? Or are we bopping around the English countryside at different locales?
No, I mean, you are going to different places, but I can see how that structure is implemented here. I think one of the more impressive things that I enjoyed about the film is that when you are traveling in the van with them, you're a literal backseat passenger. And so you're kind of, you have a really great way of observing their relationship as if you were actually in the van with them. And so I know if, you know, my personal opinion, whenever I'm around a really funny or cute couple, I look at them with admiration. And I think this gives us the opportunity to see it through that observer's eye. But then you do get moments where you're actually invested in and sitting in their perspectives, if that makes sense. But I do appreciate that at least on the journey, we're taking a literal backseat to watching their journey together.
So it's like a one shot where there's just the cameras in the backseat.
In the backseat of the van, yeah.
I dig that.
And you're watching them like hold hands in the middle of like where the armrest would be. And it's a sweet and tender way to show their closeness, but also give you an opportunity to be distant and from their relationship. And then you have other moments where you're from their perspective and you're able to really invest yourself in their feelings and their thoughts.
And the English countryside, so are they all over? Are there actual vistas in the film, or I mean, or is it primarily indoor?
So you see a lot of outdoor landscape, but there are scenes where you're going inside because they're visiting with friends and family. Gotcha. So there's a nice combination of the outside travel and what they're seeing in the world. But then sometimes they're eating somewhere or they're going to visit their friends and family and some different things occur. So you get a nice combination of what a real road trip would be. It's a combination of the two things.
So Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci are a couple. Struggling with insurmountable odds, obviously. But I want to know, how is their chemistry? Like, do you understand why Stanley Tucci wants to be the king's man? You know what I'm saying?
They are actually a really sweet couple. They reminded me of a friend, two friends of mine that are a couple. And just in terms of their mannerisms and the way that they interact with each other, a lot of the moments, the special moments they share together, are very real world couple things, like sharing a very small bed. And one person is like, I don't have any room. I'm like sitting on the edge of the bed. And then the other person's like, me too. But they have like 4 inches they could scoot over on.
Yeah.
And then the other person falls off the bed.
Selfish sons of bitches.
So it's those very real world problems that I think tries to, because we obviously have to talk about that this is a gay film. This is about two men together in a relationship, which doesn't get this standard platform in most cases. If it is about a gay couple, it's so much about them being gay. And this is not that. You feel their chemistry. Oh, you feel that they're a really good couple. But it's just so natural and normal that you don't really question and think about them being a gay couple. Like, it just, it is, you know, they're just like any other couple. And it's so much more about the acceptance of mortality.
Good.
And
that's good.
And going through the struggle of watching a loved one with dementia, but also watching, as the person with dementia, watching your loved ones treat you differently, see you differently. You know, they're mourning you while you're alive.
Which is understandable. I mean, you kind of get both perspectives of that. One person knows they're losing their mind, or their mind is fracturing, it's diluting, so to speak. And the other person is losing the person they love, you know, and that's...
Exactly.
That's going to be crushing. Does that play genuine, though? Because, you know, as well as I do, a lot of movies can make that manipulative. They can make that where it's just... It does everything to just manipulate your heart and just make it boo-hoo. But really, by the end of it, you're like, oh, God, I just feel like I was just so used. Or does it feel like that was earned because of the performances, because of the warmth, whatever?
It was definitely earned. And the one thing I'll say about this, when you watch the trailer, you're probably going to be like, ooh, I don't know if I can handle this because my heart might just break from the emotion of this story. But it's very tender and it's very gentle and it's heartwarming. It's so simple in so many ways where you don't feel like they're just trying to make you drain all of the H2O in your body from tears. That's not what's happening here. You might cry, you might tear up and cry a couple of times, but that's not really the goal here, because the goal is to try to comfort you in a way, the same way that Stanley Tucci is trying to comfort his partner, Colin Firth. And so I think that's what's really sweet about the film.
I tell you what, I'm still really mad about Schitt's Creek, because ever since that show, I tend to be crying during things more often than I ever have before. And I don't like that. I would really like to
the
just...
The show's the devil.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Like, I was watching 24 and I got misty-eyed. And I'm like, what? What the hell? Where'd that come from?
It broke you!
Yeah, the show Schitt's Creek broke me. Do you feel like the film had more to say than similar films on tough topics? Or do you feel like it was more about, it's a relationship, they're struggling, but it's really about the love?
It is about the love.
Okay.
But again, it comes back to that concept of, there's the concept of dementia and mortality, like I mentioned, but it's all coming from the place of love, which I think so much it's so dour in other films where
you're just waiting for him to lose his mind and
Yeah, and you watch that person crumble, where you see moments of those fractures and you see a bit of the sad moments, but it's so wrapped in the love from both characters because they care about each other so much. And it really becomes, and they have stressful moments because, you know, anybody who deals with something like this, a disease like this, where they can feel themselves losing control of their life. And if they're very strong willed, they're not going to want to accept losing control of their life. And so a lot of those types of personality people will say, no, that's not going to happen. When I get to this point, I don't want to be in that position anymore. Well, your partner isn't going to want to lose you either. So then there's that kind of grapple with each other of, do I let you go? Do you accept being let go? Do you accept your disease as it is? And it's very subtle the way those messages come across. And it's not so abrasive for the people who are watching. because it's so ingrained with love and care.
Okay, so if $10 is the full price of admission, what do you give Supernova?
I'm going to give it $6.50.
Okay. You know what I'm really bummed is that when you say Supernova, I just feel like science fiction epic is what it should be. So kind of bummed.
They have a connection about astrology, which is really sweet. So okay. That's where the whole thing comes from.
Now let's get into our From the Outside In topic. Serial killers. That's what we're talking about. Serial killers. People that kill lots of other people. With the little things coming out, we thought it would be interesting to ask why are we fascinated by people who kill other people in film and TV, both fiction and reality. So what is it about serial killers, John, that fascinates you personally? You love true crime and you love thrillers. What is it about serial killers specifically that fascinates you?
It's something that speaks to the human condition. Like, we are the only creatures on this planet that live for scaring each other. You don't see raccoons jump out from behind the trees and be like, ha, look, it's me, Bob. And like, oh my God, Bob, woo, you got me there.
You got me
it's
again. Like, it's you got me again.
You got
again.
Me again. Oh, man. Woo, that's so funny. It's so fucking funny, you asshole. You don't, like, that doesn't happen in wildlife. So it's, and if it does happen, that then somebody's dying. But in real life, it's something that we can't help but look at. It's like, how, why can't we just drive by a car accident without looking for the head that's rolling down the side of the street? Wow, I'm getting really dark about this.
We're awful people, is what we are, is what you're sound like you're saying.
Yeah, we really are. We really must see some death and destruction, and it makes us feel better on some sort of weird connection. Yeah.
You know, I think there is something absolutely. And it's more fiction, because I don't feel as, I feel differently with fiction than I do with like reality. When I'm watching true crime, I am disgusted. I'm disturbed. I'm horrified. Oftentimes I have to stop because I listen to true crime a lot on my runs, or I'll listen to a documentary on Netflix and just listen to it as I run, kind of thing. And that will make me stop. I have to stop because I will get so just upset or angry or whatever. But when I'm watching a movie, I'm fascinated. Absolutely fascinated that, like, I'm captivated about a person who is killing repeatedly and they're always taunting the police. So part of me wants to see if I can figure it out before the movie tells me who, because, you know, it's usually somebody that you've already met, like somebody who's hidden in the crowd. So it's also kind of a mystery. And it's just, it's fascinating to me. Like, why do you do it? It's the psychology of it. You know, Amanda, you have a bachelor's in psychology. I'm just throw that out there. You love to tell people. I'm tell everybody too.
I didn't know I do, what? But okay.
Here, let me pick this up for you. You just dropped it.
Why do you get fascinated with that? Because I would think at some point you've been studying it for so long. Don't you just not want anything to do with it?
No.
In a fictional standpoint, because I'm sure so much of it is like, oh God, that's not real psychology.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have the same true crime galore that a lot of people do now. Like, it is very trendy to be in and listening to true crime podcasts because you have to know all about it. The things that I guess I would say I'm not on board with are the ones that just try to make it too fun. And that's not a stab at anyone in particular. It's just... I don't think that that's necessarily why we shouldn't be glamorizing true crime in general.
I don't like
and
when
so
they joke
making
about it.
Fun with it, even if it's just in a podcast or a YouTube channel or something, that rubs me the wrong way. But I think it's just like John said, it's human nature for us to have that curiosity, because so much of our lives are spent trying to make sense of the world, make sense of our experiences, make sense of each other's minds and feelings. And some of us are maybe over analytical in terms of those things. So when you don't comprehend why something has happened, how someone could think so differently than you or be so differently than you or anything you've experienced, your mind has a hard time trying to come to terms and understand it. And so that's really what the driving factor is curiosity. You know, you want to learn more. You want to understand them. You want to know how they could do something so brutal and vicious, because that's not, quote unquote, how humans are built.
Well, I disagree with that. I think it's completely how humans are built.
That's a whole debate. Some people don't believe that, but there are a lot of, you know, just casual viewers who think of the brutality of murder as something that's so immoral and outside of the realm of natural human nature that it has to come from either a break in their mental state or something from their environment that has influenced them that way. And in some cases it is, but in some cases it's not.
A theory that I'm playing with in my head right at the moment is that through the 70s, 80s, 90s, the aughts, and a good chunk of the 2010s, there is a good amount of glamorizing serial killers, whether it's in news, documentary, and movies, whatever you want to pull out. There's always this glamorizing about, this man, this hunter of men who goes out and he overwhelms people and he outsmarts the police. But recently, what I really started to enjoy is seeing what those people are really like. Like there's the Ted Bundy thing that came out last year or the year before, where it shows that like Ted Bundy was just somebody who was ultimately really lucky. And that's all it really was, because when he was back up against the wall, he was a problem for himself. And it's amazing to see that he was able to even function to the level he was, because he couldn't get out of his own way as far as how, like, just obvious there was something wrong with him.
Yeah, but I don't know if this is uncomfortable or sad or just wrong to say, but I get fascinated, and not in a good way. Like, it's not something where I'm like, oh, that's really cool, I'm going to learn how to do it. I'm fascinated by the concept of people that could get away with these horrible things for so long, and they're just that much smarter than everybody else. And yes, there are cases like Bundy where you just got lucky. I mean, it was the 70s and early 80s. You know, forensics wasn't there. There's nobody to catch you, you know, that sort of thing. Like, you got lucky for a big portion of it. But then there are other people where it's just, I mean, you got caught like a fluke. I mean, Son of Sam, Night Stalker, complete fluke, mistake. And then there's people like Golden State Killer. I mean, that guy did get away with it for 30, 40 years. And he, did 60, 70 horrible acts to 60, 70 different people and never got caught? I mean, there's something about that, because I think we're all afraid of it, right? I remember growing up, nobody ever had that fear. That's when really serial killers started to become seemingly prominent, was like the 70s and the 80s. That's really when they started popping up, for whatever the reasons are. Maybe it's cultural evolution, whatever. What's that?
Lead paint.
Could be lead paint, microwaves. You don't know what happened. You just don't know.
Lead and gasoline.
Frozen pizza peaked, you know? So there's a lot of things that could have driven it. We don't know. But that seems to be when they were really starting to spike. There was so much anger in the world, and it just spiraled into these people that were doing these monstrous things. And it became absolutely captivating and fascinating, while also despicable, but really captivating. I remember when Ted Bundy got caught, and then they made a miniseries, because Mark Harmon was in that miniseries. I think it was The Deliberate Stranger, if I remember the right. And I watched it with my mom. My mom, she's knee-deep in psychology, too. Like, psychology is a thing around here in the Chicago area. And watching that with someone who appreciated that and understood that was a fascinating dynamic. But at the same time, we're both watching it with like, that guy's kind of cool. And not in the he's cool because he's a killer. It's like, he seems like a cool person. How could he possibly do those things? And that's when you get even more fascinated. You're like, why would somebody, that guy, handsome, seemed to have everything going for him. He had an Ivy League college or whatever. I mean, he was fine. His life was going to be just fine. And he just had this urge to kill people. Why? Why? And you just were captivated by it. And every performance I see where you have an actor that's actually playing with that and doing something different, you know, even not very good actors have done really good things. Like Judd Nelson was great in Relentless, which is not something anybody ever talks about, but he's a great serial killer in that movie. It's a fascinating thing. And I wish to God I could explain it, because it's probably horrible that you feel that or that I feel that way.
Well, I mean, that speaks to the interest of mystery for you specifically.
Yeah, I love to know.
You're intrigued by trying to put the pieces together and solve the puzzle. Whereas other people might not be as fascinated with trying to figure out who the killer is and beat the police investigation, or, you know, make sure you can sort it out in your mind, almost like a challenge. Other people are innately interested in learning something that they didn't know. And when it comes to true crime, you learn so much. You learn about humans, you learn about relationships, you learn about, you know, safeguards in your home and stuff. You learn about police investigation procedures. You learn about so much. And when you have that much to explore and your mind can continue to go down this rabbit hole, it's really hard to stop that. And especially when we don't have usually very clear and concise answers to it. So it's still kind of like left open as a mystery. Even with all of the serial killers that have been caught and they've established their reasons, there's still so many lingering questions. You know, even if it's about, were there people that weren't found that they murdered or,
whatever. Right? They're not going to own up to everything.
Some of them do because
how many you got? 16? I killed 16. Crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely 16, not more.
Oh, you got 18? All right, I forgot those two. I was tired at one time. Do you guys have a memory of a fictional one? I don't mean, you know, a true crime one. A fictional portrayal of a serial killer where it haunted you after you saw it? Or bothered you, got under your skin? For example, you know, everybody talks about Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter, right? Everybody talks about Hannibal Lecter. He's great, which he is. He's great. But on the same token, Buffalo Bill is the one that freaked me out.
Put the lotion in the basket.
You know, when he does that whole little dance and just everything about it is just horrifying. It's like that guy is probably out there and that scares me.
The one I think of is Peter Cushing from Copycat.
I don't get why you love that one. Maybe it's because he's so normal. Maybe that's what it is.
That's exactly right. Okay. That's what makes him such a problem. He's, you know, the actor himself is actually somewhat of an attractive guy. He is able to blend into a situation. And then as you're watching the movie, you realize he's kind of everywhere in her life. And you don't pay attention to it the first time.
Yeah.
You know, when she's first attacked, he's actually in the audience of that whole seminar where Harry Connick Jr. attacks her in the bathroom. So there's a lot of things in that movie. And because Peter Cushing is such, like, again, he is somebody who blends in and was able to get as close to somebody as possible. And also, again, killed a lot of people and nobody suspected anything from him.
I wouldn't say that this one haunted me, but it did sit with me because it was more... It was so grounded in the potential of reality, and that would be American Psycho, where he's basically this really handsome, nice guy, and there's debate on if he actually did it or if it's all in his mind. But still, let's talk about the actual killer moments. He's so crazy in it, and you can't understand how someone who seemingly has all of the great things, like you said earlier, Aaron, could do something so menacing. And that one sits with me more so because I know there have been real serial killers in the United States that have been those handsome, charming guys and have murdered and hurt many people because people were unsuspecting.
Yeah.
And so those are the ones that are really more scary to me than the gruesome faced ones or something. It's the people that I could see working at the bank or living next door or, you know, the mailman or something. Just obscure, normal people that you wouldn't typically picture to be a murderer.
Hey, so I just want to cut in on something real quick that she said. Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. Handsome? Yes. Successful? Yes. Nice? No.
Okay. He was. But he still had a level of charm to him when he wanted something.
He was kind of smarmy and just so full of himself. He was not a nice guy.
But there were when that movie came out, that was the thing. Women loved men that were a little bit full of themselves and had a
rich,
level of arrogance.
Handsome, power broker, confident. Yeah. He was a popular figure.
gross.
I just want to make sure we all understand he wasn't nice.
I just want to make sure we all understand that. Can you really suspend disbelief to picture like a rich, successful executive, you know, killing somebody to get ahead? I don't doubt that, especially with Huey Lewis blaring in the background. I have no doubts this happens. None.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and somebody covers it up. And also, I will say, you know, John Doe, I know we can't talk about Kevin Spacey anymore, but John Doe is one where it really unnerved me because he got so... I don't know what it was, but they did such a wonderful job of like framing that movie, how Fincher shot the movie, how he waited to really present the killer until the end. So he's really, he's an ominous figure the entire movie. When they come across him, you don't get to see his face. You know, you're following him like they're following him. And it just made him more menacing. And then when you see him and then he has that monologue in the back of the police car and everything he says is true, is like, you only caught me because I let you. And it makes you think like, that's a lot of killers. Like there are a lot of people that have done this and gotten away with it. So it kind of really hit a nerve too. That whole, plus got to the guy's wife. Eesh, it's not good. What's the box? So it's easy to get seduced by a wonderful performance, but do you have a different reaction to watching an actor terrify us versus a documentary on the real thing? Like I talked about that, like Bundy Dahmer, when you hear or watch real serial killers in action, does that terrify you more, or it's really just about the same?
Oh, when I see a you're talking like fictional character versus non-fictional character, essentially.
Yeah, real serial killer versus portrayed on
documentary
TV.
Versus fictional.
Yeah.
So when I see a fictional serial killer, I am more enamored by it. I can have more fun with it. I can. Because I know it's not real, and it's
cool
it's,
kill it's, stuff like that.
Yeah. You can you feel like you have a level of enjoyment with it, as morbid as that is. A lot of us who enjoy thriller and horror films enjoy the creativity of a serial killer and the way that they murder or plan things out or whatever your interest is in. And I can get that, but I would never feel the same way about a real serial killer in a documentary. I wouldn't say, wow, they planned that out so well. I'm very impressed and good job for you. That was an amazing kill, how you just decided to like skin their head off or something. Wow. Or like their back. It becomes more grotesque and it becomes more bone chilling. And it also makes me look over my shoulder a bit more when it's a documentary. It makes me question the people in my reality, whereas a fictional character is something that's, I don't want to say jovial, but sometimes they can be fun.
When you
like
see
Scream.
Someone that's handsome like Patrick Bateman, you're like, get away. Get away. 20 feet at least. Keep away. Can I help you with that? No. I will drop these things. It's fine.
Yeah. And it's almost like you can say that they're handsome when they're not a real serial killer, when they're a fictional character. Like in Scream, I can say, yeah, he's cute. But
no, Skeet Ulrich.
Yeah, yeah. He's cute.
I can get that. But Ted Bundy, you know, even though you know he's a good looking guy, you just feel dirty even saying that.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like, yeah, he's handsome. Ugh. And they always
Jeremy Renner played him once.
What's that?
He is
Jeremy
actually
Renner played him once.
One of my favorite performers.
Grumpy Cat's not handsome?
No, he's not. He does look like Grumpy Cat. His face is very Grumpy Cat-ish.
Okay.
He's a decent looking guy, not in that movie.
I mean, if your options are limited, sure.
This is a weird conversation already.
Go ahead. Sorry, I don't want to put him in a hurt locker. What are you trying to say, Amanda?
Oh, no. To his point, I was just going to say that's Jeremy Renner's portrayal as Jeffrey Dahmer was actually one of my more favorite ones. Because
that,
he...
My Friend Dahmer or something like that, right? Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yep. I have not seen that one. Is that a good movie?
I think it's streaming. I thought it was a pretty decent movie. I mean, it's not anything that's going to rock your world or anything. And you probably know most of the stuff that's in the film.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable how much I know about that.
It does make it's a little unsettling because it just seems like a normal guy and you're just following his path until you're like, oh. So I think it's more enjoyable for people who don't really know much about Jeffrey Dahmer.
Have you ever seen an interview with Dahmer? Like a real interview. There aren't many, but he is kind of a regular guy. And it's very uncomfortable because if you just like walked in the house and somebody had that on TV and you just heard him talking, you're like, oh, who's this dude? Who's this dude? And then he'd be like, well, then I had put his head in a jar. Wait, what? What? Like, you just don't see it coming. I mean, you can kind of almost see how he used that to his advantage. And it's, that's even more terrifying, I think. What about you, John? Do you get more unnerved by real ones or about the same?
I find the fake ones to be much more interesting to watch because they start, you see those actors make the decision to say, hey, we're going to make this more about it being a predator. And you're seeing somebody who is trying to put themselves in a position. And of course, they can't help but glamorize bits and pieces of it. When I watch like a documentary on Dahmer or a documentary on Bundy or any of these other ones, I spend a lot of time going like, okay, and this is when they caught him, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. How did you guys miss him? Okay, wait. This is when you caught him. He is out in the open doing something. He's being stupid. How did you guys miss him this time? Okay, now this is, and that's what I spend most of the time like focusing on, is just the absurdity of every situation, because it's almost always some absurd situation as to what helps these guys continue to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I just bang my head against a wall about that whole thing.
Yeah, one thing I find the more and more of them that I've seen is when a really great performance of a serial killer by an actor is when they underplay it. I really don't like Anthony Hopkins was just brilliant in terms of the fact that he seems so unassuming for a great portion of that movie, which is what makes him more uncomfortable and more unnerving to us.
Right.
But most actors would overplay that. I would actually say, you know, Brian Cox in Manhunter does a completely different take, but a very similar take on how he underplays Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. And anytime an actor does that, to me, that feels like, okay, that's more what a serial killer is like, because they aren't, they're not making bold choices. They're not making bright mistakes that should be caught, you know, because they're being so dramatic or they're making an obvious slip up or something like that. Because an actor has a tendency to want to go big in these kinds of roles. Well,
even Mads Mikkelsen, same character, but he was nearly superhuman when Mads Mikkelsen was playing him.
Oh my God. And I can't, this bugs me, right? This is a legitimate criticism of about every serial killer movie that does this. When they constantly drop their little hints to that they're a killer, like, oh no, what are we having for dinner? You know, well, I bet you taste marvelous. You know, stuff like that. Just random nonsense like that. A real serial killer would do everything they could to mask that because they've been practicing. So to me, that just screams lazy writing. And it feels like, okay, you're trying to hint to the audience that, ooh, maybe they're going to catch him. I don't like it. I just don't like that aspect. No.
Right.
But real ones can terrify me. Some of them, I'm just like, wow, you're so dumb. I don't know how you got that far. Like, you're just, because Ted Bundy is an idiot. Like, when you really watch the documentary, you kind of feel like you're a lucky idiot.
Oh, all of them are lucky idiots. Dahmer was another case of like, you know, poor kid got away from Dahmer. Cops caught the kid.
Oh, that's a horrible story.
And Dahmer shows up and like the kid's all got a drill, you know, a drill bit sticking out of his head and everything. And Dahmer's like, oh, my boyfriend and I were having a fight. And the cops were like, ooh, let the gay guys walk away while we don't touch it and get the gay on us.
That guy should have been charged, by the way. The cop should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He should have been. That's a whole different story. But in terms of watching the real ones, like I just watched the Night Stalker documentary on Netflix. And they do a really good job because they kind of keep the actual killer until the very last episode. And it's really horrifying. Like he's one of the most uncomfortable serial killers in history just because of how unempathetic he is as a character. He just loved the attention. And then the women that were just throwing themselves at him, I'm just like, what? I don't get that. That's a weird thing.
The guy had a graveyard for a mouth.
Oh my God. He's horrible. He opened his mouth and you would literally be terrified. You know, it's not a matter of braces. He needs an entire mouth. Just get a new mouth. Yeah. But when his mouth's closed, he's kind of a handsome guy from afar, I would say. I mean, maybe he has an allure, I think, to him. But as soon as he opens his mouth, the frickin' devil. Just terrifying. Whew. All right. So what stands out to you? We talked about a few of them, but what stands out to you as your other favorite performances in serial killer films and television?
The first one I can think of off the top of my head is Dan Stevens in The Guest.
Yeah, I guess he would be a serial killer, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He went from house to house. He took over lives and he lied to them. And again, as somebody who's very unassuming and getting themselves into, you know, into stuff. And he's one of those charming monsters that is hard to get away from.
That bar scene when he beats the shit out of those kids.
Yeah.
One of my favorite movie scenes in the last 20 years, sincerely. Because it's just so, he's so charming. And then he just beats the shit out of everybody.
Yeah. Another one that really pops to mind is Charlize Theron in Monster. Oh,
great one.
The Eileen Wuornos story.
Yep. Great one.
Oh, my God. Like, it's so hard to watch that movie and go, that's Charlize Theron. Because she completely disappears into that role. And she, like, you know, anything you know about looking at her, or being one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood, when you see her in that role, you're just like, what am I looking at? Because that's, like, that's all her.
What that reminded me, like, her performance was so raw. It reminded me a lot of, like, Henry Rooker and Henry. Did you ever see Henry? I don't know if you ever saw that one, but
I don't know if I did either. I don't think so.
Henry Rooker played a serial killer. It's called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Very disturbing movie. Her monster, kind of similar, but but Michael Rooker just looks like Michael Rooker. So the transformation for him is, you know, it's like literally one step. He just walked in the door.
Right.
Hers is about 48 steps to get from what she looks like to make herself look like that horrible, horrible person. She deserved the Oscar for sure.
Yeah, she really did. She was amazing. And then finally, again, like I already mentioned him once, but William McNamara's Peter Cushing from Copycat. Again, I think he's pretty great just because he's really what a serial killer is.
All right. Amanda, what do you got?
One from television that's popped into my mind, and it's a more recent one, is Martin Whitley from Prodigal Son, played by Martin Sheen.
Oh, he's so good in that. I just
he
watched
is excellent.
The episode today. On my lunch, I was watching that. That's so good.
Yeah, I really, really like the way he portrays his character because he has a level of it's just some sort of dynamic that he has where he has compassion and love for his children, but he also aches for them to be different. But he also really likes when they're murderers or they do something bad and it's some way for them to bond. And he is very satisfied killing people and he's feels glory in the fact that he knows he's good at that. And it's just very haunting. I do feel whenever someone gets close enough to a serial killer and it starts to make me feel uneasy about their safety, mm-hmm. That's how I know that is a terrifying character.
He is so good about going from, because he's such a kind of like a lovey grandpa uncle kind of character. I mean, actor. I mean, he's kind of frumpy and he just seems so approachable. But when he snaps in that show, he doesn't do it very often in that show, but when he snaps, it is horrifying. Like he is so good.
Yeah.
What else you got? What about Dexter? I mean, you're a huge Dexter fan.
Yeah, I do love Dexter. I have a very conflicted feeling about him because I'm so sympathetic to him. Because
it's so weird when you're rooting for the serial killer, right? You're like, good job, buddy.
It's bad because I don't always feel like he's the bad guy. Like he's taking out for generally bad people. And so it's like, I don't know. It's fictional. It's not really that bad if he's taking out the bad guys for us. But I don't know. I mean, as a serial killer and his techniques and everything about him, I think he is what we all envision a well-rounded serial killer to be. You know, he has everything that's pristine. He has a process. He knows the cleanup. He knows how to handle everything. And he'll dismember you and nobody will find you. And that's what we envision when we think about a successful serial killer.
I don't know if successful.
I just want to point out the phrase well-rounded serial killer was uttered.
I know. Somebody is going to just make my life out with that quote.
I remember in that show when he killed, what was the character's name? Dokes? Was that his name? And
oh, God.
The cop?
And surprise, motherfucker.
Yeah. And you're like rooting for Dexter, and it's the worst thing ever. He's like, oh, man, I hope you get him, Dexter. And then you're like, wait, but he's actually in the complete right. Dokes is absolutely 100% in the right. Why am I rooting for the awful serial killer? But he Michael C. Hall, just, man, he is so good in that role. He really, really is.
Yep.
You know,
it's perfect for him.
There is another one who we don't have confirmation is classified as a serial killer, only a murderer at this point. But I have a feeling this person has at least gone on. It's a fictional character, has gone on to be a serial killer. And that is Amy from Gone Girl. She is terrifying. And I know she only had a couple murders in the movie, right? Because she killed Desi.
Just one.
Okay, well, okay. So she only had one, which is why I said she's not a serial killer. But I imagine she has done more and will do more, though we don't have confirmation of it. And she is the type of person where I can see she's so manipulative and well planned out that's... Okay, you crazy.
Look at Amanda trying
that to... That chick terrifies me.
Right?
She does, but I don't think she qualifies. She's not a serial killer.
She's not a serial killer. She's not a serial killer. I did preface and say that she is not, right. But I feel right. like she has gone on... Nick's probably dead, let's be honest.
Well, I'm guessing your list is done if you're going to people that aren't serial killers. So, we...
I tried to go with one, okay? Usually I don't get to pick more than one.
It says performances, yeah, plural.
Yeah, it says plural. Exactly. That's on you. And I would throw, Dexter, John Lithgow was really good.
Oh, he was fantastic.
He was really great too.
I will say Jigsaw, just because I really like how kind of almost laid back he plays it when he's on there.
Yeah.
Would you like to play a game?
And he's just planning, just working it out. You know, he's just laying there the whole time, the first movie. He doesn't even do anything, really. He's just chill. So I thought that was great.
I want to point out something. He always says, would you like to play a game? But you're already in the game by the time he asks you that question. So he's not really giving you much of a choice.
It's rhetorical.
It's a total cheat move. He's like the worst guy to play Monopoly with. He's got money in his pocket.
Really?
Yeah, guaranteed.
Yeah, because I would be like, every single you want to play a game? No, I don't.
No, I'm done. I'm good. Well, here's what you got to do if you want to live. I'm like, that's not, I literally said I don't want to play. So you are a cheating bastard. Other ones, this is a real big, I'm a big fan of The Collector. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but there's
Bone Collector, huh?
No, not The Bone Collector. The Collector.
Yeah.
It's totally different movie. That's the one, and there's a sequel called The Collection. But the first one is The Collector, and it's basically a burglar breaks into a house, and when he gets in, he finds out that there's a serial killer already in the house, and he has to decide if he can get the people that are in there out safely, or if he just saves his own ass before the serial killer finds him. And both movies are, I love them to death. Like, they're fun little thrillers that nobody talks about, but I absolutely love those movies. And he's a great serial killer because it scares the shit out of me every time he comes on screen. So check that one out if you can find it, The Collector. Norman Bates, obvious one. And then lastly, it's an older movie, Robert Mitchum's Harry Powell and the Night of the Hunter. Just a really great classic serial killer. So those are mine. Do you guys have a favorite documentary on this subject? That's a little harder of a question, I think.
I think most recently, my favorite documentary is Don't Fuck with Cats.
Oh, that was so disturbing.
Oh, yeah. That was excellent. Good choice. Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons why it's great. The killer himself isn't the reason why it's great, but the process in which they went through in catching him and how they peeled that onion is really interesting to pay attention to.
How the social media and stuff helped them catch him.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that was disturbing.
I will say, you know, it's you don't know who the killers are often, but well, no, because it's not serial killer. That's just murderers. That's different. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Well, I'm glad we're here to have you talk yourself out of
it. I know. I was like, wait a second. They're going to tell me that doesn't qualify, and then I'm just going to have to backtrack anyway.
I'll give you a real documentary. This is The Zodiac. It's about the Zodiac Killer. Find it. Watch it.
Oh, that's another good serial killer movie.
Fascinatingly detailed. Movie's very good, too. But there's a movie called The Town That Dreaded Sundown. And it's shot like a documentary, but it's not. But much of it is real, but also there's stuff that's not. So it's like real facts and it's fictional. And it's like this hodgepodge of a film that kind of comes across a little bit like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that it's meant to be real gritty and realistic in many ways. It's not technically a documentary, but there's a lot of real truths in there. But it horrified me as a kid. absolutely horrified me, because most of what happens in there is true. And that's just one that came to mind. What do you got for listener comments?
A Tori Melching, she says, I find them fascinating. What makes them become one? How they got away with it? Then usually how they got caught. Floppy disk? Did they stop between killings? And if so, why? It's like a puzzle that will never be solved, just more pieces added.
It's like a puzzle inside of Enigma, inside of a
riddle
puzzle.
Made of human flesh.
Made of human flesh.
And teeth. Baby teeth.
Lauren Thomas Williams says Mads as Hannibal was one of his favorites. Ruth Wilson's Alice from Luther, Stanley Tucci in The Lovely Bones, Paul Dano in The Prisoners. He wasn't a serial killer, but Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo. These are all his favorite performances, and these are really great ones, especially the Robin Williams one.
Lovely Bones is a good one.
And Prisoners. I mean, Paul Dano's are just, he is a good actor. I wish more people would appreciate him for what he does, because he's got some good stuff. Jennifer Miller, trying to understand the psychology between them or behind them and how they deviated so far from society, yet somehow they often go unnoticed. And I do want to mention Stefan. He said, I guess it's about understanding what makes them tick. Also, as a movie, with right direction, chasing a serial killer on the silver screen is something intense and scary at the same time. Agreed. All right, what do we got for upcoming releases?
We've got some good stuff. The Little Things is coming to theaters and HBO Max on January 29th. Deputy Sheriff Joe Deacon joins forces with Sergeant Jim Baxter to search for a serial killer who's terrorizing Los Angeles. As they track the culprit, Baxter is unaware that the investigation is dredging up echoes of Deke's past, uncovering disturbing secrets that could threaten more than his case.
Following that, we have Palmer on Apple TV Plus. To the pie, to the square root, to the whatever nerdy thing that Apple TV needs to put behind their logo. This is also on the 29th. An ex-convict strikes up a friendship with a boy from a troubled home. This is directed by Fisher Stevens, which is actually a really cool pull for a director. And this stars Juno Temple, Justin Timberlake, which I'm sure that's the reason why everyone's going to watch it anyways.
Well,
and
yeah.
Dean Winters.
Yeah, and I made it a mention. Huh? It's Denzel Washington, Jared Leto, and Rami Malek and Little Things. Did you say that? I don't know if you did.
I did not say that. Yeah. No, I didn't. But, you know, they're definitely a reason to go watch
but
that.
But Justin Timberlake, as he's playing like a real character and it's down and dirty. Yeah, I'll check it out. I mean, hopefully he does a song at some point. But
does a song and dance kind of thing like he did in Southland Tales, right?
Sure. Why not?
Am I the only one that saw that one?
The Rock saw it.
That was a great Rock performance.
Also on the 29th, we have Finding Ohana coming to Netflix. A summer in rural Oahu takes an exciting turn for two Brooklyn-raised siblings when a journal pointing to long-lost treasure sets them on an epic adventure with new friends and leads them to reconnect with their Hawaiian heritage.
Aww.
Sounds sweet.
It actually looks like a Hawaiian Goonies, honestly, if you watch the trailer. It looks kind of fun. Really does.
It really does.
Yeah. All right. Any recent film or TV recommendations we haven't already talked about real quick? John?
Well, I think if you haven't sat down and watched the Godzilla vs. Kong trailer about 1,500 times and dissected it, that's about the best thing that's going on right now.
All right. Fair enough. I will recommend Alone on Hulu. It's about a woman who recently lost her husband. So she's kind of running from her life and she packs everything in her car and she drives away. And then she starts thinking she's being followed. So her life and survival depends on what she chooses to do as she goes forward. That's all I want to say, but it's on Hulu, and it's definitely worth the watch. The Marksman, on the other hand, I saw in theaters with Liam Neeson, and you can avoid it.
Oh, wow. Good to know.
He has a specific set of skills, and they're too old to be used.
And he's used all of them up?
Yeah, they're all used up.
I really can't wait for him to do Police Force or Police Squad.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because it's about time for him to stop trying to use those skills and go back to the comedy.
I agree. Naked Gun. Yeah, Naked Gun, right?
Yeah, Police Squad. I had it right.
You did, but it's actually called Naked Gun. He's been talked to about that with Seth MacFarlane, right?
Oh, Seth MacFarlane?
Yeah, he's behind it.
Even better.
There you go. Hey, Peter. So, Manna, what about you? Any recommendations?
So, I finished Orphan Black. I am finally done with the series.
You already recommended that one. You got anything new?
But I finished it.
Cool.
You got anything new? Okay, that's great. Move along.
Well, I don't have anything else then. I was just really excited to talk about this.
Okay. quickly. We've already heard about it.
No, it's okay. It was really great. I'm very impressed with Tatiana, and that's all.
Tatiana Maslany is the best. I can't wait to see her as She-Hulk.
So talented. I could not believe that these were all these characters that she were all her, but they were so different.
Yeah, every single one was different. She should have gotten an award for that role. Speaking of Tatiana Maslany, I did start watching Perry Mason. I saw the first episode. That is worth a sit.
It gets better as it goes.
Yeah, it is like dirty and gritty and gross the whole time, but I'm really into that first episode.
I love the vista, the visuals, the backdrop. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Yeah. It's pretty great. I mean, everyone needs a bath and a shave, but it looks pretty great. I don't know which one in which order, but yeah, it looks pretty great.
Matthew Rhys does a really good job as it goes. So, Manda, we started this thing. I think it was your recommendation, a weekly streaming recommendation. So, you get assigned a network and you have to find something to recommend, whether you've seen it or not. And you have Hulu. So, what is your recommendation?
So my recommendation is a film called Beach Rats. It follows a teenager named Frankie on the outer edges of Brooklyn as he struggles to reconcile his competing sexual desires, leaving him hurtling towards irreparable consequences.
Oh.
Yeah, it's honestly, the performances were pretty good. The story was really interesting. And if you're one who is maybe drawn to that inner complexity of trying to find yourself and accept yourself, and especially when it comes to an LGBTQ story, this is not like Supernova where it's very overt. It is so much about him trying to accept himself and I guess even figure out if he is gay, because that is something he's contending with. And he has a woman that he's trying to make a relationship work with, and it's just seeming really difficult for him. And so it's him trying to come out to himself, basically.
Beach rats.
It's only a couple years old.
We're moving to Classic Corner. But first, we want to say, share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group or on Twitter at BuyPopcorn. Our site is thehollywoodoutsider.com. Our email is feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. Please rate and subscribe us on your preferred podcast app. And lastly, you can find John's artwork on Insta and Twitter at rjohndraws. Amanda on Veronica's Marshmallows and Smirk and at Sink Into This. Me on The Blacklist Exposed and presenting Hitchcock and at Aaron Smirks. Now, Classic Corner. Midnight Run is the film we're talking about, so shout out to John Parrish for picking our first one for this hopefully monthly segment. What we did was we chose a film that is at least 30 years old. All three of us watched the film before the recording and then ultimately decide if it deserves to wear the crown of a classic film. Midnight Run follows bounty hunter Jack Walsh, played by Robert De Niro. He's a disgraced cop out for one last score, one last job for his bail bondsman, Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants, as he's called in the business, as he seeks to bring in an accountant named Jonathan Mardukas, played by Charles Grodin. He skipped bail and embezzled $15 million from a vicious mobster named Jimmy Serrano, who's played by Dennis Farina. And he's vicious, vicious. I'm going to kill you, and then I'm going to kill your fucking wife. That guy. Terrifying. Along the way, the mob wants Mardukas dead. John Ashton's Marvin Dorfler is brought in to steal away Mardukas from Jack, and the FBI's Alonzo Mosley is bringing everything down to get Mardukas back to testify against Serrano. So Midnight Run debuted in 1988. It was directed by Beverly Hills Cops, Martin Brest, and written by George Gallo, who also wrote Bad Boys and Relentless, that movie I talked about earlier. And it's a mostly unknown favorite of mine, which happens to feature Judd Nelson as a serial killer, if I didn't say that. Okay, so Midnight Run. Manda, this was your first time seeing this.
Indeed.
So we're asking you first, what did you think, and does it hold up for a movie of today?
Man, I really enjoyed it.
Really?
I really, really, really liked it.
Because you're used to seeing Robert De Niro like the last 10, 15 years, right? I mean, you
know. I mean, yes, like that's my more recent memories of him, but I've definitely seen him in some of his older works where he was just a cool badass and he wasn't some old grandpa and like Meet the Parents or whatever. But yeah, he was a lot of fun here. He was hilarious. That's actually probably one of my more favorite things about this movie in particular is the humor, because I don't laugh at movies anymore the way that I do 80s films. 80s films just have such a different style of humor that you just don't get anymore, where it's just nobody gives a fuck. Nobody cares what they're, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, they just don't care. And he is just so brash and just says what's on his mind and doesn't care about anything other than his end goal. And it's a fairly simple story that gets a little bit messy, and it's fun along the way. So
there's a couple nice chickens back there, Jack. That's so funny. John, what do you think? Do you think this movie holds up for you?
To some degree, it does really still hold up for me. It's got like the relationship aspect of it. It really plays out much more like a love story than it does anything else. You know, guy meets guy, you know, they don't like each other. They start to build a respect for each other. And then guy has to let guy go because he starts to really care about him and wants to see him continue to live and be free. And like, it's kind of a beautiful story that
way.
Well,
when you put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong?
No, she's
not at all, which is why I said like it is. Okay, fine. You sold me. It's a romance.
You know, it's the kind of thing in like guy friendship that like some people may really need in their life, where it's just a mutual respect is built off of life experiences. And it's just great. The film itself really does take its time with everything, which is something that movies these days don't do. Like, it was a good 20 minutes before we saw Charles Grodin, and that's fine. And that's okay. It lets us sit with our primary character or our first primary character for long enough to get to understand why we shouldn't like him, but should like him both at the same time. And then Charles Grodin's there to be able to carry the movie.
Grodin. Huh? You keep saying Grodin. It's Grodin.
Grodin. Grodin. Grodin. I've heard it both ways.
No, you haven't, but go ahead.
Whatever.
He has when he's speaking. He hears it the other way.
Right. When I say it, I hear it the wrong way. Anywho, like, he's able to carry the movie for the majority as far as being able to allow for the comedy and allow for the fun. And his just delivery of being kind of quirky and dry at the same time was awesome.
He's so dry. He's so dry. So the thing I love about his sense of humor, and De Niro is great. Like, I mean, this was like picturesque De Niro for the 80s, because he was totally riffing off his own characters. I mean, because he had played so many just dark, gritty guys. So the idea that he was making this guy who would make jokes randomly, but it was mostly just yelling, you know, and he was just, will you
start by shutting up?
Just stuff like that. And he's just constantly yelling at everybody. But Grodin is so dry, so completely dry throughout the entire movie. And I think he only has a couple scenes where he actually gets animated, the one where he's on the plane. These things go down, they can't go up. You know, that's a fantastic scene. But most of it, he's just playing dry, and he's just getting under Jack's skin throughout the entire movie, which completely works for me on every level. Because
I already know you for all of 2 minutes, and I already don't like you. Gee, thanks. I like you too. I really like you.
So funny. Just so funny. To me, it definitely holds up. I was actually kind of surprised how well it holds up. I watched it with my wife, and she had never seen it, surprisingly. And she said it. She loved it. She just thought it was a great movie.
It's so fun. To me, this is like classic 80s.
All the way. Yeah, all the way.
Yeah,
all the way.
Just everything about it.
But it also, I mean, because Martin Brest directed it, he also did Beverly Hills Cop. It's a very similar feel in terms of the action comedy. I mean, it's not quite as outlandish because you don't have the Eddie Murphy. I mean, De Niro is no Eddie Murphy in terms of comedy.
Right.
But they play with what works. They make a really fun buddy action comedy that really works. And I feel like there's real stakes in it, which matters. You know, I really feel like at the end, you know, you kind of get how much De Niro has come to appreciate this guy, because the whole reason he does that, he's not doing it to save his ass, because he's an honorable guy. He's not trying to go to Serrano. He's trying to get Serrano, sure. But he knows if he doesn't make that deal right then, that Mardukas is probably going to die. So he's trying to do, like, the whole movie, he's frustrated that his whole life was screwed up because of this Jimmy Serrano. But he is, in a way, trying to do right. In many aspects. And it isn't until like close to the end where he starts seeing maybe his code isn't what it should be. And Grodin kind of brings it out in him. So it's a good buddy flick, because they both grow.
they both develop as characters.
And the moment with his family where his daughter comes outside, I was like, God. Oh, it was so sweet.
She sad. Offers to give the money and he doesn't take it. Thank God. He doesn't take it.
Yeah.
If you could see any two actors from today play these roles and be the exact same movie, who would it be?
Well, Ryan Reynolds would be Charles Grodin.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I mean, I feel like that's a no-brainer. God.
I'm feeling Bradley Cooper.
He's not gritty enough.
No.
I don't think he's gritty. I mean, that's your choice. Sure, I could see it, but not gritty enough for me. I don't know. You know what would be fun? Hugh Jackman, Ryan Reynolds. Jackman could do that. That would be fantastic.
Okay, but Hugh Jackman's less gritty than...
You're out of your gourd, man. He can play gritty as... Did you see Prisoners? He'll be fine.
Yeah, I saw Prisoners.
And they rub on each other really well.
Wait, what?
Really?
Well, okay. That's not how I meant.
I want to see a video of that. All right, Jake Gyllenhaal. I mean, everybody here is a Gyllenhaal fan. I could see that.
Yeah.
All right, Jake Gyllenhaal. That would work, too.
Yeah.
I love that we all... agreed on Ryan Reynolds from the get-go, though.
There's nobody else that does that kind of comedy anymore like he does.
Yeah,
like nobody is better at dry wit than Ryan Reynolds. Nobody currently.
Yeah, the only person who can out Charles Grodin would be Ryan Reynolds.
And Reynolds is probably quicker. I think Grodin is better at completely dry, though. I mean, right. He can play dry. I mean, it's just it's amazing how straight he keeps his face when he's saying some of the stuff he's in.
What about...
Let's get back on this movie.
Hold on.
We're not remaking
on.
This movie right.
Hold on. What about... And you're going to know his name because I'm not going to know his name, and I should. The main actor from Justified.
Timothy Oliphant.
Timothy off with his pants?
Off with his pants. Timothy Oliphant and Ryan Reynolds would be a lot of fun.
Awesome. Let's go back to this movie.
Sorry.
Do you feel like this movie is a classic? Why or why not? I guess is the question I'm asking.
Yes, I do think it's a classic. I think it's a not as well known classic, though, because I don't hear people talking about this film that much. Maybe they did back when it came out. I'm not really sure because I wasn't alive.
Right, but I'm not trying to cut you off. I'm just trying to clarify.
By cutting her off.
Absolutely. I'm going to mansplain. So what I'm trying to say is take apart what other people think of it. Do you think it deserves to be considered a classic despite what anyone else?
Well, if you would have let me finish, I would have gotten there.
All right.
Can you get there faster? Can we pay you to get there faster?
See, now that's appropriate because I do talk too much. You can pay me to do a lot of things, and that's one of them. So, yes, I think it's a classic personally. It has all of the particulars from the 80s that everyone enjoys, and it has still in its own way a unique story. And I think that's kind of what holds it up. And the comedy has not gone... It hasn't gone by the wayside throughout the years. It still holds up. The movie itself still holds up. It's got a lot of really great moments, and it doesn't take too long to find some enjoyability in it.
Yes, but there's not enough words left that Amanda hasn't used to explain why.
I didn't use that many.
So mean. You're so mean. Go back to watching your Godzilla bullshit.
Right.
Yes, it does. In fact, it's really hard for me because I would already consider it one, but I realized, you know, when I've been talking to people about this movie that I am alone often. A lot of people have never even heard of this movie. So it deserves to be considered a classic, I think. There are so many movies that I feel people consider classics from the same era that I don't understand. So this to me deserves to definitely be. It's one of the best action comedies of the entire decade of the 80s.
The thing is, for me, it left me wanting to watch more movies like it.
Yeah. Yep.
Give me some more suggestions of films like this because some of the types of 80 movies I like. Did he really go and just watch Godzilla? Because you told me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was watching the Godzilla trailer.
You have a problem.
Is now not the time to do
it?
Now's not the time.
You just almost made him fly to Florida and cut your head off.
I'm going to serial killer your ass. Recommendations, Stakeout, 48 Hours, this one, obviously, Tango and Cash. Those are some. There you go. There's a few. The 80s had great buddy comedies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we all agree. Midnight Run is a classic. Kind of curious what you guys think, so let us know. But as for this podcast, it is done. We are done. We are out of here. So remember, the next time you head to a theater or sit comfortably on your couch waiting for one to open, buy popcorn.
Yeah, monster, like big old monster movies have not been my thing. Like kaiju monsters have not normally been my thing.
Your microphone is, just so you know, you got to put your microphone. You're not talking into it. Sorry, live people.
Let me get closer.
You don't have to get closer. Just talk at it.
Okay, well, I can only put it so far in front of me, Aaron.
All right, sorry. All the way in your face. That's what they want to see.
Yeah, just get up in here.
You're good. Go ahead.
No, we're going to get this, Aaron. Move it up a little
bit. No, just the microphone towards your face. That you don't have to hide.
It's literally like,
hey,
I can't.
There are people watching this.
There's two fingers between me and the microphone.
I don't know why it's a shocker.
Ew. Don't make it weird.
Stop. I'm going to cut in real quick. Mark Burns says, literally has nothing wrong with her mic. And we spent like 10 minutes with her fussing with her mic.
Who said this?
Mark Burns.
Hey, Mark Burns, I edit. I'm telling you, there was something. You just don't know. And now I got to write this down, Mark Burns, because now I got to edit this. So technically, you cost me twice.